I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Jan Martel's The High Mountains of Portugal has already been a critical and best-selling book since its release in February. It's described as a suspenseful story told in three intersecting narratives, taking the reader on a journey through Portugal from the early part of the 20th century through to the 30s, through to the latter part of the 1990s. The themes of love, loss, belief, and faith are throughout. I'll get Mr. Martel, who joins me now, to talk about his new book, about the process of writing it, and its reception thus far. His previous books include The Facts Behind the Helsinki, Roca Marius, Self, Beatrice and Virgil, and 101 Letters to a Prime Minister. His book Life of Pi was an international bestseller, selling more than 13 million copies, a 2002 recipient of the Man Booker Prize, among many other prizes, and the basis of an Academy Award-winning film. He lives in Saskatoon, but joined me last week while in Vancouver for an appearance with the Vancouver Writers Fest. The High Mountains of Portugal is published by Knopf. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Jan Martel. Mr. Martel, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Have you got pets?
Well, as a matter of fact, I do. We have a little black Havanese dog. It's a small breed. And we got it not because I write about animals, but because we have four small children, and children and dogs go well together.
Yeah, and I mean, growing up, because you have written about animals a lot, I'm curious to know the relationship you've had with animals. Did you have pets growing up, say? Did you like going to zoos?
I certainly did, actually. My parents were diplomats, so we were posted, my parents were posted in Costa Rica, a tropical country. And there we had all kinds of pets. We had turtles, we had rabbits, we had, briefly we had a monkey. But you know, at that age, I treated animals the way lots of kids treat animals. They were like playmates. I anthropomorphized them to death. So my thinking about animals evolved only much, much later when I wrote Life of Pi.
And so they do teach you about people, though, don't they?
Well, that's it, yes. That's animals are... can be mirrors to us. I mean, they can be who they are. You can also look at animals with a degree of objectivity, and that's interesting, the way they contrast with us. But they can also, yes, they can be a mirror to us. I mean, you know, especially domesticated animals, for example, in terms of love. A dog's devotion to its owner is a kind of, we interpret as a kind of love, and that can be useful for a child. And it's also useful in terms of the loyalty that a child has for an animal, that you know, animals need a kind of, they need to be taken care of. So it's very good for children to have pets because they have to take care of them. They have to clean after them. They have to feed them. They have to brush them. It's also a good tool to develop empathy.
So the characters in The High Mountains of Portugal have suffered loss to a certain degree. I mean, all of them, I guess, have lost people in their lives. And I'm wondering, when you're writing these folks and about their grief, does it inform you as to perhaps how you've dealt with grief in the past or how a reader might?
Absolutely. And that's, in fact, one of the reasons that I write the books that I write is to learn how to live. You know, I put stuff in my books that I hope not to live. So, obvious example is Life of Pi. I've never been shipwrecked. I've never lost my entire family in a shipwreck. But in writing about it, I hope to learn how to deal about it should it happen to me. I think, in fact, I think that's one of the main points of fiction, is we do in our imaginations what we either want to learn about in reality or want to avoid in reality.
So the worst possible situation, that's something that a writer would write about, I guess.
Yeah, just so that you can know what it feels like. So if you meet people who've lived that, you will have a sense of what it feels like. You know, in fact, since you bring this up, this is exactly why I sent for 4 years books to Stephen Harper. I sent him 101 books to sort of say, listen, if you read a great book, it's a wonderful tool for empathy. It'll open up your heart, open up your mind, make you walk in someone else's shoes, make you feel someone else's life. And that can only be useful to a politician, because after all, you're representing other people. You have to know people. Fiction is a wonderful way to explore the lives of others. And in doing so, it's like you live an extra life.
So what do you know now about the human condition that you didn't know before writing this book?
Well, I know about, you know, one of the key lessons in life is letting go. You have to learn how to let go, because after all, that's what life is about, is the letting go of everything. The letting go of youth, the the letting go of energy, the letting go of ambition, the letting go of trying to control people. It's all an exercise in letting go. And, you know, there's an element of tragedy to that, but it is just what life is like. So you have to learn how to let go. You have to be able to transition from one stage to another. So the novel is very much one of evolution. You know, the Tomas, to me, feels like the section of a younger man. The middle section is one of someone who's more mature. And then the last section is very much one of someone who's older in life. So the novel is sort of reflects the different ways we are at different ages. So part three is one of more of acceptance. But it's also kind of like a state of grace. So Peter Tovey has managed to transition to a state of acceptance, which is why that section, by the way, is called Home. Mm-hmm. It's part one with Tomas, this in a sense, rebellious museum curator. That section is called Homeless.
And do you think that these stages of life that we go through, our faith in whatever that might be, does that increase, or do you think you can be, say totally engaged with faith at the beginning, not the beginning of one's life, but say in one's formative years, say?
Faith, well, that's a very tricky question. That's where organized religion gets it completely wrong. You know, teaching kids about Jesus or Buddha or Allah is very tricky because kids tend to be literal-minded, and there's nothing literal about religion. Religion is, in fact, the most refined metaphoric metaphoric, yeah, approach to life. So you need to understand metaphor. You need to be able to understand in layers. So it's much too subtle a product for the literal mind of a child. So I suspect that religion should come to... I suspect teenagers can approach it. Teenagers start having a sense of the bigger picture and the bigger questions that will yield a sense of that bigger picture. So I suspect that it's teenagers who might be interested in starting to look at religious texts and thinking in those terms. But anything younger, to me, is likely going to poison the mind of a child who, once it discovers that it's not literally true, it can't be taken as literal truth, they'll be disappointed and turn their backs on it. In a sense, the way they do with, let's say, Santa Claus. Mm. You know, little kids believe in Santa Claus, and very quickly they're disillusioned by it and they turn their backs on it. And despite what some cynics might say, there's a big difference between Santa Claus and, let's say, Buddha or Jesus or Krishna.
Yeah. In your own spirituality, I mean, that's obviously changed over the years. Is it more now than, say, it was, say, in your college days?
Well, I can answer that question in two ways. I could say it's completely irrelevant. I mean, just because I write about religion doesn't mean I'm religious. I could write a novel about slavery. It doesn't mean I hanker to own slaves. I come from the secular mainstream. My parents were children of the Quiet Revolution in Quebec, mm-hmm, you know, a fiercely anti-clerical rebellion, where everyone turned their backs on the church. I was a grandchild of that revolution. I grew up with absolutely no religion. And I've only become interested in religion because it is actually very interesting. Despite being demonized and despite the excesses of organized religion, which I wholly agree with in condemning, you can't reduce religion to that. I equate religion with a grand act of storytelling. To me, religion shares in many ways the kind of magical thinking that yields also great art. In other words, you look at reality and you interpret it in such a way that you see more. Mm. That's what a great novel does. A great novel reinterprets reality and changes the way you look at it. Anyone, you know, people who've read great novels, people who've read Tolstoy or Lord of the Rings or whatever, it changes their view of life. To me, that's also what religion does in an even deeper way. It changes the perception of reality in a way you cannot prove. That's the whole point of faith. If it were there proofs for it, it wouldn't be called faith. It would be called evidence. It would be self-evident, and there would be no discussion. It wouldn't be imaginatively interesting. But it's a rereading of reality that completely transforms it. And that process can be really, really interesting. It has, unfortunately, been kidnapped by any number of homophobes and anti-Semites and patriarchs. But religious thinking is actually, there's much more to it than that. And that was what the great thing I discovered when I wrote Life of Pi in India. I saw much more benign manifestations of religion. So where do I stand in that? Well, yes, as a result of writing Life of Pi, I've chosen. It is an act of will. It's not a passive thing. I've chosen to believe that there's more than just a material reality, that underpinning it there's some sort of a greater plan. Now, do I have some proof for that? No, none whatsoever. So, you know, Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens would laugh at this, but it's what I choose to believe. And having chosen to believe it, I continue to investigate it. And that investigating of it is extraordinarily interesting. I find now sort of passive rationality that most people in the secular world live by actually quite dull. And it's very doable when you're young, healthy, and wealthy. But when you get older, it leads to nothing. Because, you know, reason in itself is just a tool. There's no purpose to use it. And so people get deluded by short-term uses of reason. They get, you know, caught up in all these technological baubles or short-term ambitions. But there's no great breadth to those, and there's no great depth to that kind of use of reason. You do have to ask bigger questions, and bigger questions ask for bigger answers. And whether they're true or not is not the point. There's something very subjective about life. And it's investigating intelligently that subjectivity that, to me, is what religion is about.
Yeah, I guess that's why they call it faith rather than, say, as you said, evidence or proof. I've always wondered with people of faith who have faith to whatever religion that might be, whether it actually works in terms of alleviating suffering.
Well, I can give you one example of one case where it does. I remember one of the reasons I wrote Life of Pi was of a story that was based here in British Columbia. Remember Rena Virk?
Yeah.
Rena Virk was a young woman who was beaten by her so-called friends and left to drown. And that was horrifying in itself, but it happens all the time in our society, unfortunately, violence. But one thing that struck me, that stayed in my mind, was the reaction of the Virk family. I think it was 2 days after her body was discovered. The first thing they said to the media was, "We forgive her killers." And it turned out that they were religious, that they were Jehovah's Witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of dodgy Christians. I mean, Jehovah's Witnesses I don't hold in high esteem. But nonetheless, my reaction at the time was, my God, a belief system that makes them able to say, "We forgive her killers," within 2 days of her body being discovered, that belief system has to have something going for it. Because I suspect your usual run-of-the-mill, secular-minded person who doesn't give a thought at all about anything but the material, when something like that, the murder of their daughter, lands on their lap, they have no tools to deal with it. It just completely destroys them. It's utterly meaningless suffering that just rips them open, rips them apart, and they have no tools. The Virk family managed, even if they had bitterness in their heart and it was just words they were saying, they still managed to say those words and it therefore be their ethical goal to forgive the killers. So that really amazed me. I said, my God, there's got to be something for that kind of thinking. So, yes, I think one of the things that religion does is it posits a bigger picture, of which one small portion, let's say one streak of color, is pain, is evil, is suffering. But that is part of a larger canvas, which somehow makes sense. That's the standard response of religion to suffering is, you know, God's ways are mysterious, that we're too small, too limited to understand. But if we could see the bigger picture, we would see that it makes sense for children to die because, you know, God needs them in some form or other. Now, is that satisfying? Of course it isn't. It's still horrible to have children die.
Yeah.
But that kind of rationalizing of evil is better than no rationalizing at all. Better than just saying, no, my daughter died for no reason and that's it. She won't live. And I have to live with that. And that bleakness, I suppose, is doable. I mean, there's plenty of people who lose their children and soldier on. But to have a narrative that reframes that and puts it in a greater context can be effective. You know, one other example of that, I give you one personal one, a grander one. Look at the Jews. You know, one-third of world Jewry died during the Second World War. Two-thirds of European Jewry died. And so they continued. Now, some became irrevocable atheists. Course, how could a loving God do that to us? But others nonetheless managed to soldier on. So clearly they managed to put the murder of 6 million of their innocent brethren in some kind of context where there was still a loving God. So that's another thing that's extraordinary about faith, is that for people who have the right kind of understanding about it, it's a very much a self-reinforcing mechanism. If something bad happens to them, they're being tested by God. If something good happens to them, they're being rewarded by God. But either way, God is always in the picture. And that kind of grand storytelling, I find fascinating. That's what I write about when I'm writing about religion. I'm not defending stupid, monstrous, you know, pedophile Catholic priests. I'm not defending some imam pontificating about women. That's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's that kind of grand storytelling that is universe transforming.
Now, where you set your books, is it important for you to have been there, to have traveled through, say?
Yes, because I find fiction often works if it's based on a ground of verisimilitude. So, yeah, I went to India several times, and it was important that it feel real, the India of Life of Pi. Just to a certain extent, the Portugal of the high mountains of Portugal. Although the landscape I describe at the end of those plateaus with those great rocks, that's completely fictional. That's a mythologized. But Lisbon, and generally the landscape a bit, it was somewhat based. It had to feel, it's good if it feels real, because then once it feels real, it feels credible. And then you can take your reader somewhere else.
Is there a place other than, say, within North America that you haven't lived that you'd want to live in?
Oh, God, there's so many places I'd like to visit. I mean, I'm very happy living in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. There's a great community there. It's a really good quality of life. But, you know, I'd happily live in BC for a while. You know, I'd live anywhere, most anywhere for, you know, several months. Now, I have 4 small children, 6, 4, 2, and 10 months. Children like stability, so you couldn't move around with them too much. But once they get a bit older, I very much look forward to showing them the world. One of the great experiences of my life has been traveling with my parents as a child because they were diplomats, mm-hmm. and then on my own backpacking. To me, the world is a vast Russian novel with, you know, many chapters, many characters, many plot developments, stunning settings. It's the world itself is a novel, and it's a beautiful novel.
What do your kids know about the work that you do?
Well, my 6-year-old, the oldest, is, you know, he's fully aware that I wrote Life. He's quite proud in the sense that I, you know, because it was turned into a movie, of course none of his little coevals, none of his 6-year-old friends have read Life of Pi, but because it was turned into a movie, some of them have seen the movie, or certainly their parents told them about it, and they've seen maybe snippets of it that weren't too violent. So, you know, the fact that I'm a rock star at his school, he's quite proud of, because, you know, that's kind of neat. But they're much too young yet to have read any of my books. My books, despite featuring animals, and are still very much grown-up books. So right now, yeah, Theo, my 6-year-old, is quite proud of me because it was turned into a movie. So he's more proud of the fact that it was turned into a movie than the fact that I've written a book.
You know, you mentioned the books that you sent to Harper, and I was thinking if you had to suggest movies to him, what might they be?
Oh, a good question.
Because I was thinking, you know, if he uses the excuse that he doesn't have time to read, we all have time to watch a movie, say, on the weekend. So, you know, I'm wondering what you'd recommend.
Well, the same thing that I did for books, in a sense. You obviously want to be entertained, but you want just to be entertained. In fact, movies are a perfect example. Movies that are just too entertaining often, I find, don't leave you anything to think about. So, you know, as soon as you ask the question, the first director that popped into my mind is Ingmar Bergman, the Swedish director. You know, he's done, I went through a whole cycle of watching a whole bunch of Ingmar Bergman when I was at university. And they're really fantastic. They really, in a very engaging way, look at the human condition. They're beautifully shot, while simple. There's no extraordinary special effects, but they're beautifully shot. And they're, you know, fully fleshed out characters and really engaging situations. So I definitely say you should watch them. Bergman movies. I remember loving a movie by a Russian director named Nikita Mikhalkov, who did a movie called Dark Eyes. I think it won the Oscar for Best Foreign Movie. Mm. It was based on some Chekhov stories. And it's with Marcello Mastroianni. And it's a fantastic movie. It's both funny and moving and done by this brilliant Russian director. I thought those are just sort of two movies I would think of.
Yeah. Have you got time to watch much television?
Well, television in the sense of cable, no. My partner and I will watch series, HBO stuff.
Yeah.
So we've seen, you know, Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. which we've loved. It's Shakespearean. It's phenomenal. We watch Eye Candy, like The Hundred. Alice was really into The Good Wife. We watched Mad Men for a while, but then I sort of... So we don't, you know, with four kids, we don't watch much.
Yeah, yeah.
Recently, we were watching a Netflix documentary called The Making of a Murder.
Oh, yeah.
And we haven't seen all of it yet, so don't say anything about it. But we watch things like that.
Yeah.
But between family and work, we don't have that much time.
I'll bet.
We have a 10-month-old. Our youngest is 10 months old, and he tends to wake up early, so we tend to go to bed early. So that curtails some screen time.
The other thing I was wondering about in reading up on you is how you read. And are you, I mean, do you still read with a, prefer to read with a tactile book, say, or are you an e-reader?
I have both. I mean, I often sleep with my 10-month-old, with my baby, and so I have one of those backlit e-books, and I love it. Although, all this technology, there's nothing wrong with it in itself. You actually have to know how to use it properly. So I find e-books are best for fiction, because fiction usually presents a very unified story. So you are in that story, and you can just start, you can just continue reading it. And so e-books are great for that, because you don't have to flip around in a novel. It's rare that you start a novel and you want to flip 10 pages back or 50 pages back. For nonfiction, they're not as great. Nonfiction, you do tend to want to look at the table of contents, flip back, look at footnotes. You want to jump around the text more. And for that, e-books aren't great. So I read This Changes Everything by Naomi Klein on an e-book. And it was hard to, because she follows many, many strands, it was kind of hard to get an idea of the whole. That would have been easier if I'd read the physical book. So it kind of depends on what you're reading. As I said, reading at night with my baby, not wanting to wake him up, to have a gently backlit e-book was great. And you can make the print bigger. You don't know a word, you tap on the screen and the dictionary pops up. So for that, it's great. But I also like physical books. You know, physical books are in a sense, the real thing. And you can, it's a more tactile, physical relationship with the thing. But it also costs a tree. And, you know, they're not available to everyone. They're available to everyone if you live in a big city. If you don't, it's hard to get those physical ones, whereas e-books can be downloaded from the internet.
Yeah.
So there's pluses to both. You know, I think it's a question of balancing them correctly.
So you've been asked, as you've toured with this book, about sort of the reaction to critical the sort of reviews of the book, and then sort of you're asked about the commercial success of previous books. Now that this book's been out for nearly 2 months, is there relief on your part now that it's out there and that the notices have been quite good?
Yes. You don't live and die by reviews. That's not, you know, that's not the purpose. You don't need validation. But I think what you're talking about is that art is a gift. Art is profoundly social. You know, you write, you draw, you paint, you score music, meaning to reach out to others, to communicate your experience of the human condition. And so what's nice is that, yes, people have accepted it and read it and entered that dialogue. That's what's really important. Yeah, obviously I'm happy that it came out and it didn't get trashed by reviewers. That wouldn't be nice. But it's not that I'm calibrating my contentment by, you know, every positive thing said and then I feel downput everything I hear negative. That doesn't, like, you know, there's been this, for example, recently there was in the Walrus, there was some sort of,
yeah.
I didn't, haven't even read it, but there was a very negative attack on me saying I'm a one-trick pony and all that. You know, fine, the guy felt that I needed to be assassinated. Well, great, I guess I'm worthy of assassination. You know, I just move on. I mean, you don't, when you write, it's a gift to the world. You just give it, and what the world does with it is their own affair. I've been lucky that Life of Pi, for example, was taken to by so many readers around the world. My next one, Beatrice and Virgil, had a much rougher time. Some people absolutely hated it, but so long as they'd read it, that was fine. They obviously weren't ready yet to look at the Holocaust in new, different ways, which we'll need to eventually. But so long as they read it and therefore engaged with it, you know, wrestled with it, then that was fine. They don't have to like it. So you know, that's you have to develop a certain skin when you write. You have to, in a sense, write for yourself, and after that, let go. You know, I was mentioning that earlier, the importance of letting go. So each time I've let go both of the success of Life of Pi and, you know, the relative, you know, failure of, you know, or the negative reviews that I've received for some of my other books. You just let go. You have to move on. So it's more the process than the end result that counts.
And if you do get, say, criticism about a book, whether it's from a reviewer or a reader, say, does that influence how you write in the future, the next book, perhaps?
No, because you sort of forget. You know, there's the odd thing. I remember I had a writer friend who read a draft and said, you know, Jan, you use the word thing too much, too often. Yeah. So you can damn well bet now that when I wrote The High Mountains of Portugal, every time I used the word thing, I made sure that I actually needed to use it. Mm. And, you know, so there's, you learn from criticisms. But beyond that, no, you know, when I write a book, I'm not going to generalize. When I write a book, I basically close the world. I close the door on the outside world and I get to work. And, you know, the kinds of questions I ask myself are the same that I ask every time. You know, what am I doing here? How do I do it? Okay, this doesn't work. How do I improve it? It's this kind of joyful, creative. I'm like a, you know, Hephaestus in his smithery on Mount Olympus, banging away, making bronze shields. And, you know, it's this wonderfully intimate, creative time. And the outside world is basically ignored. You know, the first reader who has to be satisfied is me. When you're a writer, you're two people. You're both a writer and a reader. And in that dialogue between the writer and the reader, it's really, really exciting. And then after that, you put it out and you let go and you sort of hope that other people see it the way you saw it. And I've had the luck with some of my books that indeed readers did agree with me that, you know, this was a tale worth telling. As far as I can tell, and it's hard, you know, to look at myself from the outside, my progression has been fairly organic, led by, you know, growing up and getting older, and led by my maturing interests and things. So I already have an idea for another novel, and I'm just now starting to explore it in my head. And it's exciting. It's exciting. And I'm just motivated by the interest that I have in the topic that I've chosen. I'm starting to think of what books I might read, what angle I might take. I'm wrestling with really basic questions about character and stuff like that, and that's really, really thrilling, and that's something that's entirely in my head.
Now, we've seen the photographs of the shed, I guess, at the back of your house on the New York Times site this week.
Yeah.
That's where you primarily write? You're not writing on the road, say, or anything like that?
No. Yeah. That's where I wrote 95% of the High Mountains of Portugal.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure talking to you today. I've enjoyed reading the book. It frustrated me, though, at the beginning, and I'll tell you why. When Tomas gets the car from his uncle, and you go through in the book all these details as to what the car, how it works, all the stuff that he has to bring with him on his journey, I found myself getting frustrated, and I realized why. It's because I don't drive. And he's going through sort of the process that I'm going through, because I guess automobiles at this point are new to that part of the world, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's why I found it.
No, you would be. You know what's funny? One of my early readers of Life of Pi loved everything except she didn't say anything about the animal part, and I was really worried that saying maybe this didn't work, and she finally told me that growing up she never had any pets because her parents were allergic, so she had absolutely no feeling for animals, none whatsoever. They mean nothing to her.
Yeah.
So that's when I said, oh, okay, that's why. That's why, you know, you didn't react at all to the animal stuff in Life of Pi. Well, the same thing with you. If you don't drive, and listen, I didn't learn how to drive. I didn't have a car until I was 38 years old.
Mm.
I was totally indifferent to cars, so I can understand that would frustrate you, because that's a big part of part one, is this man overwhelmed by this vehicle. That was a big part of it.
Yeah. So you said 38. I'm 33, so I've got 5 years, I guess, to...
Yeah, and I bought one because I moved from Montreal. You don't need a car in a big city.
No, not
a...
Yeah.
Between bicycles, public transportation, and taxis, or the odd time, you know, renting a car, you know, sharing car share.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that exists in Vancouver.
Oh, it does, yeah.
Car sharing. You don't need to buy one, because if you do, it's expensive. You have to park the damn thing. But I finally got one because I left Montreal and I moved to Saskatoon, so I had to drive across the country. And in a small prairie town like Saskatoon, you do need a car. And plus, when you have four kids, you definitely need cars.
Absolutely, so. Yeah. Well, thanks for this. I've enjoyed the chat.
Yeah, me too, Joe. Thank you very much.
The book is called The High Mountains of Portugal. It's published by Knopf. Jan Martel joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.